Hello, fellow writers. The end of the year is a great time to look back at what filled you up in the past months. And for many of us, that's not just our writing, but the time we've spent helping others with their work. For some of us, that's come out in small ways, but for others, it's a calling and an opportunity to build a career doing work you love. Our sponsor, Author Accelerator, provides book coaching to authors like me, but also needs and trains book coaches. And they'll be hosting a free book coaching summit in January for anyone who wants to learn more. If that's got your ears perked up, head to authoraccelerator.com/summit.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2.
Okay.
Hey, this is KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, be they fiction, nonfiction, proposals, final drafts, pitches, essays, whatever it is that you are working on. We are the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and a forthcoming book about preventing substance abuse in kids. And I am deep in the land of editing right now. And you can also find my work at The Atlantic and The New York Times and The Washington Post.
And I'm Serena Bowen, the author of 30-odd romance novels. And I am revising a book called Heartland, which will come out in the late winter. And my revision is due on Monday.
Ouch.
Yeah.
But you're going to make it.
Yes, you're going to make it. I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of a novel coming out next summer, as well as How to Be a Happier Parent, coming out in paperback next summer, and former editor of the Motherload blog at the New York Times, where I occasionally still contribute, and right now, not, in fact, in the land of editing or revising or anything along those lines. But I will own that my bold declarations regarding NaNoWriMo and trying to finish my current project all were for naught. I did not. It is not quite the end of NaNoWriMo as we record, but I can guarantee to you that I did not write 50,000 words of a novel during November. But that's okay. I did a lot. I needed to do a lot of thinking. So I could not write. If I had written 50,000 words, it would not have been a good use of my time. Sometimes it turns out that way.
Well, I said I pulled the rug out from under my NaNoWriMo anyway. So I've been doing something that was completely unplanned and has been going pretty well, actually. And have also, this is also fun news. I had a meeting with my editor, the same meeting that I had post sort of her taking a look at the first, you know, at the first draft of Gift of Failure. And whereas the Gift of Failure meeting was vomit inducing, it was horrible. Some of you have heard this story, but it basically, to suffice it to say, it was a nightmare of a meeting with your editor, the very kind of meeting you hope you don't have, although she's quite a lovely person. This meeting was its exact opposite. It was lovely. It was a love fest. Everybody's happy. It was just really, really nice to have a positive meeting to offset the negative meeting that I had after Gift of Failure was turned in. So I'm 0 for 2 now. It was very exciting.
Wait, you're not
0
for 2.
No, you're 1 and 1.
No, I'm
1
for 1. 1 and 1? Is that what you say?
I was going to look at it a little more positively and say not many writers can have such a ringing guarantee that they have learned.
Well, that's actually something that has been really interesting. I had a huge checklist of basically the what not to do stuff. And it was really nice because during the meeting, she said, I could tell that you were trying really hard to not do the things you did last time. And I'm like, oh, you have no idea. You have no idea how organized I was in my efforts to not make the same mistakes twice. So that was a ringing endorsement of at least my anal retentive sort of attempts to do better this time, to learn from my mistakes.
Massive gold star.
Thank you.
For learning all the things.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about other things that we've learned today. We do have a topic, and I'm really excited about it.
I'm really excited, too.
Yeah. Today's topic is covers.
Cover art.
Cover art. Yes.
I can fall so deep into this whole, like, this topic, especially now since I'm at the point where I get to start sort of, like, really thinking about this. This can consume me for days.
So we're going to talk about covers when you need to create your own cover, covers when you're working with a publisher and they are presenting covers to you, covers internationally, covers, you know, what it is when you are working with a publisher, what you ought to be thinking about. So let's just start broadly, like, you know, what makes a good cover?
Well, I was thinking about this yesterday as we were getting ready for this, and I had a really good time thinking about it and making notes.
Oh, good.
And I thought that at the end of the day, there were really two things that every author is supposed to think about, two broad things, and they are, number one, reader expectations, followed by, distantly, trends. So when I say reader expectations, I mean that all of us, when we walk into a bookstore and we take that first glance at the table in front, and maybe your eye comes to rest on a book, I don't know if until you're in this seat where you have to think about it, that you really realize how much information you're getting from that cover just at the first glance about, is that book fiction or nonfiction? Is it literary? Is it practical? Is it a romance? Is it for children? You know, you get a lot of information really quickly. And when it's time for the, like, gut-wrenching question of what cover art is going to be on your book, you have to, like, back out a little and think with your analytical brain about what information you want readers to have.
This is something that when Gift of Failure was in the process of, you know, getting its cover, the first round of covers really were a clear statement that my publisher wasn't really sure what this book was. And so when we backed up, we had to do some real, my agent and I did a really clear conversation about what exactly do you want this book to say about what's inside. And I knew little things like I wanted people to be able to know what this book was from far away. Like I wanted someone on the other end of a subway car to know, say, oh, I recognize that book. But above and beyond that, if you think about what Gift of Failure is, it's a parenting book, but it's an education book. And so there were all these, like, how do you convey that through a cover design? And it's really a tricky thing. And looking forward to the next book, I don't even know where to start with that. But I love the fact that you have to somehow get all of these messages across graphically. And that's what's so exciting about a cover.
It is. And we should also say where Gift of Failure ended up as cover art, because it's really
right.
Telling. And it was such a great
right.
Cover.
Well, and it was a total redesign. And when my agent and I rejected the first set of covers and asked for a redesign, we had the image. We found the image of a ladder with a broken rung. And then we're like, oh, but what if the ladder was made out of pencils? So that was kind of a joint effort between me and my agent. So while my agent said, you know, she never, hardly ever recommends that an author sort of say, here, look, here's a cover design. She was very into the idea of us giving them ideas, especially once it seemed like their artists were stuck.
I want to jump on the word rejected.
Yeah.
Because you didn't. Because you couldn't. Because,
yeah, that's
true.
I have not
read your contract, but
that's
I can
true.
Almost guarantee that that right is not in there.
How so about we gently yeah. suggested
But that is something to be aware of. When you're, if you are in a situation where you're working with a publisher, you don't have control over the
right.
cover art. If the publisher said, no, what we really like for the book, The Gift of Failure, is this, you know, shot of a Christmas tree with presents on it and, you know, gnomes hanging off of it, and that's what we're going with, you really got nothing. So when you're in that situation to take like a sort of more diplomatic approach is very necessary.
That's,
because
that's
every
a really
new
good
design
point.
Costs them money too, right?
Right. And it, in one case, my first novel was women's fiction for Penguin in 2011, basically. And when I first saw the cover, they hired an outside illustrator to make it. And I was told up front that that was sort of an expensive thing to do. And they said, here is your cover. And I freaked because the cover was a whole bunch of things that did not make sense for this book. It looked vintage to me, and the book was straight up contemporary. It was super busy, and I have to tell you, it had Comic Sans as the font for the title in black, and the rest of the cover was not dark colors, and I just lost my mind there for a minute, but... But after I freaked out to my agent, where and you're allowed to do that, I wrote...
Yes, that's the person to freak out to.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Then I wrote very carefully a note about not just how much... I didn't actually mention how much I loathed with every fiber of my being, like the imagery on this cover, but rather I explained why the readers we were looking for would not pick up that cover.
Mm-hmm.
That it looked too old.
That's great.
That it looked too big. You know, because my opinion... is not important to this equation, but reader opinion really is.
Right, so, that's a fantastic point.
Yeah, that's where you want to go with your angst, is here's why this would be an error, you know, in a very analytical way.
Right. I had this really cool situation with my publisher where I can't remember if the CEO, president, whatever, of my publisher was teaching a class on publishing at a college. And the one of the books that he had offered up to the students to do some sample covers for, just to sort of get an idea of how marketing works, one of them was mine. And the student got in touch with me through my website to talk to me about the fact that she had chosen my book as the book that she was working on in this college class on publishing, which was really cool. So that meant that my publisher was thinking about my book, not only from the perspective of I am the publisher of this book and we want people to buy it, but I'm teaching students about marketing using this book. So it was a really cool opportunity to have lots of perspectives, but also, you know, unique. Not many people get that opportunity.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
My nonfiction, The How to Be a Happier Parent, came back to us the first time with an image of like cartoon parents on a roller coaster with their children, about which there were many, many problems. Among them was that all the parents and children were white. And also, being on a roller coaster does not make you a happier parent. I mean, you know, it had its points. I could kind of see where they were coming from, but we did something similar where we went back to them with just talking about how we didn't think it represented the book. And ultimately, they asked me, like, well, what do you like? You know, give us a set of, and this same process, just to jump ahead, it happened to me with the novel. You know, show us some pictures that you like. Show us covers that you like. Tell us what it is you like about this. They actually did that in the case of the novel before we even went into it. So in the case of How to Be a Happier Parent, I actually gave them a magazine that I like. It's called Flow. And if anyone ever found Flow and also found the cover of How to Be a Happier Parent, it ended up kind of looking like an issue of Flow. It has a chalkboard and a floral and sort of it's very trendy, to be honest. It's a very, and I like the cover very much, but it's definitely of its time. And then for the novel this time around, I just gave them, I went to the publisher's website and tried to pull covers from their website that I liked.
Yeah, that was actually really fun to just think about the novel cover with you, KJ.
Yeah, we all pulled. We were all pulling things, and it was really...
It was super that was fun. Very, and that's kind of where part two comes into this, which is what trends have to say about what should be, you know, on the cover of your book. So one is reader expectations. And with The Chicken Sisters, you know, this is a novel about sisters. It's not a spoiler to say that. So it's contemporary. It has a family dynamic. It's... there's an element of competition regarding the whole book is about a contest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
you had all of those things to kind of juggle and play with. And then there's also the trends of what's on the cover of women's fiction right now. And you and I...
Well, and not just what's on the cover, but what colors, because it turns out, and I had no idea, obviously there are trends just like in fashion for colors. And you can see what colors are trending when you go to your local bookstore.
Oh, you totally can.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. All of a sudden, everyone decides teal is the color, or everyone decides, you know, yellow is. It's really fascinating to watch.
Yeah. Let's hope yellow is the color of 2020. That's what I ended up with.
Well, yeah, it
the
is.
First, so we, the Chicken Sisters went through to two cover drafts. So the first cover was very typical of commercial women's fiction that commercial small, you know, the tropes and Chicken Sisters, just to, you know, use the lingo. It's, you know, it's a small town. There's restaurants, there's you know, foodiness, there's women, there's lots of conversation. That's not really a trope. Anyway, the first cover was a picture of two women sitting in a restaurant talking. And there was nothing wrong with that. Like, it was fine, but it didn't really leap
it for me. It lacked conflict.
It lacked conflict. Yeah, it didn't. It looked like a happy women's commercial women's fiction book, which it is, but it didn't show the sort of that it's a dynamic story. And also it like yours, it looked a little vintage. So, and it's a very contemporary story. And so we went back and sort of went through it again and talked again about different color covers. And the thing that they came back with when they decided to do a complete redesign is such a perfect, like, icon. They've got, what they've got is two women's hands pulling at a wishbone, which you guys can see. We will put it up in the show notes, of course.
It's so perfect.
All over my Instagram, and will continue to be all over my Instagram for the next.
Well, here's a question. Did you suggest the wishbone, or did they come up
with it? I did not. They came up with
it. It's so good.
It's terrific.
Yeah. It's really perfect.
Like,
because
I
that
don't
first
know.
One, you're right. It really did look like two friends sitting down and having a cup of tea together. But this is perfect because there's the conflict, there's the competition, there's the luck, all of that stuff. It's great.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then I suggested, we made it super clear that they were two different, they're different hands. You can tell by the fact that they've got different nail polish and they look a little different. And then it's got this background of sunflowers, which I love. And apparently floral backgrounds are super trendy, but I love them because the book is set in Kansas and sunflowers are very Kansas. So that won't really... I think what that communicates to readers is just... I don't know what the floral background communicates to readers, to be honest. I like it. I pick them up.
It's just an id item. It's pretty. Like, who doesn't want to look at sunflowers? And we should also say, KJ, that this whole cover art, so gorgeous, is illustrated, because that is also a big trend right now. So I don't... In the 90s, I read lots of, like, chick lit novels that had illustrated covers, like the Bridget Jones era.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a while there after chick lit kind of had a big moment and then went away that that like illustrated was gone from book cover land, because it was like, you can't say anything serious underneath an illustrated cover. So illustration,
I'm trying to remember what they look, the pause here is me trying to remember what commercial women's fiction looked like in the interval. I guess
Well, there's photos of like porch swings and Adirondack chairs and women on beaches with big floppy hats.
Yes.
So, and all of that is still there. Like Ellen Hildebrand has beach covers, but hers are starting to look more illustrated.
They're starting
too.
To be illustrated pictures of women on beaches in big floppy hats. And let me just say, I love a good women on a beach in a big floppy hat novel. So, you know, it's a good cover. If there were a beach and hats in my novel, I'd have been all over that.
Right.
I have to say, all of the books I was going to talk about today, I've done this fun reversal to, like, you know, stuff I don't usually read, the sort of women's rom-com stuff, and it's all illustrated. You're totally right. I was just looking at the covers.
Yeah, and that's new. So, and it's also hitting the romance market pretty hard right now. So, like, 4 years ago, you couldn't find a single romance novel with illustrations on the cover. It just didn't exist. And, you know, everybody knows the history of romance covers with Fabio and, like, ripped, you know, shirts open and people.
But a couple obviously screams romance, so people were used to seeing that. And then we hit the 50 Shades era, and also self-publishing kind of ripped up all the rules because people didn't have, you know, photo shoots at their disposal. So
they were busily, you know, sort of begging their brothers to stand around shirtless while well, no, they, and it just wasn't working for became, whatever reason. Come on, be great for your Instagram. Yeah.
It became a stock photo market. And there are certain stock photo models that when I see it, that I just laugh because they're so overused. Like there's this one model that I call creepy-eyed Santa guy. And I went...
Cowboy Christmas!
Yep, I went for years without a photo of creepy-eyed Santa guy because there are a whole bunch of photos of him with a Santa hat on, but lots of photos of him without one. And then my Czech publisher actually used creepy-eyed Santa guy on one of my Czech editions, so now I do have that guy. But then 50 Shades of Grey came along, and this author chose to put, like, cufflinks and a necktie on her very stark covers.
And it was self-published, so that was her choice.
I think you mean handcuffs there, Buckaroo.
Oh, no. That's true. Not cufflinks.
No, there were cufflinks.
Were there?
Yeah.
Oh, I only remember the tie and the handcuffs. I don't remember the cufflinks. Excellent.
Well, no, there were like fine menswear stuff was on those covers.
Gotcha.
And it was moodily lit, so it just looked like, you know, the guy took off his tie because he had things to do. And...
for people to do.
Yeah, and that just ushered in what now in romance people call object covers. And so now if you see a book cover with a slip on it or just some piece of clothing moodily lit on a dark background, it tells you that that is going to be a very erotic book or have very erotic themes because that one author changed the way that romance novelists looked at cover potentials in that subgenre anyway, by her own success made it that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That is very cool.
So, there were so many like things to sort of tease out of that. And one of them was your international publisher. But I wanted to, I was thinking about the question of illustration. Oh, I know. You tried an illustrated cover lately or you were, we're talking about reader expectations, and I know that recently you had a moment when you felt like the cover that you chose did not meet your reader's expectations.
Oh, yeah.
We want to hear more about that.
Sorry. We do.
Well, that was just last month, and I was spinning off a character. So he was from my Brooklyn series, and I had retired him from the hockey team in a book, and I was spinning him off into a story about his family's very bizarre security company, like a cybersecurity thing. So I needed readers to know that that beloved character was getting a story and that they were connected. And my wonderful cover artist, she is so talented, made me exactly what I asked her for, which is something a bit trendy with a bit of a blur to it, really interesting cover for this new series that had an element of suspense. She did exactly what I asked her to. It was gorgeous. And the pre-orders for this book were terrible. And I panicked. And they just didn't improve. And I thought, well, something's just wrong. Like, readers really like this guy. They'll like this story. The blurb is good. Like, I knew enough to know that which things ought to be working. And so I woke up 6 days before the launch positive that the cover was a problem. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write my poor cover designer an email and say, listen, I've made a big mistake. Do you have any time to help me? And she said yes. And I bought a photograph from a photographer that day. And I sent it over to her. And we changed the cover so that you can tell that it's a spinoff from that other series by the typography.
Right. Now it looks like the other series.
Right. It does, except the background is dark instead of light, and there's no sports imagery on it, but you can tell from the typography. And the minute I showed it to people, another author who reads some of my stuff said, oh, it's a Brooklyn book. And then I knew exactly at that moment that I was right. And that book ended up doing great. It hit USA Today at number 89. It's performed in line the audio was selling well. Like, everything about it did what I'd originally expected it to, but I had confused my readers, and they did not know what to make of that new cover.
Well, and how brave of you. Well, and keep in mind, not only how brave of you to make a change at the last second, but making a change at the last second involved a lot of moving parts that, A, you couldn't necessarily have anticipated, like weird moving parts that that we can go into in just a second. But the other thing is, in terms of expectations, it's okay if your readers expect this to be a Brooklyn Bruisers novel, because they'll pick up that it kind of sort of a little bit is, but it's a new entryway into a whole new series. So you didn't have to worry too much about people getting confused by it being but not being a Brooklyn Bruisers novel.
Right, because that was true. It's just that I had lost them at, like, maybe it doesn't have anything to do with any of your other books. Right. And that was a mistake. And basically, I was kind of tired of putting shirtless men on my covers. And I wanted something artsy and interesting. And it didn't work. Like, my readers were not ready to, you know, well, they just weren't there for me to, you know, say, hey, my brand today looks different than, you know. You have to respect the brand that you've built. Right. And that's the mistake I made.
Here's a question. Does the illustrated trend extend to indie? And if so, is it a pricey thing to do to have an illustrated cover?
You know, indies are a little confused about it because many of our cover artists are not illustrators. Mm-hmm. And so I have some friends that have found good illustrators to make this trend work for them. And then there is stock illustration, though. So a good cover artist isn't necessarily going to freehand everything.
Right.
Like, you can find illustration vectors that will contain the imagery that you're looking for, and you can move it around however
Even
you wish.
Even publishers use that stuff. There is a little bird on the cover of How to Be a Happier Parent that I really loved and wanted to use in other places. And we had a problem because it was not, they had licensed it, and they had only licensed it for cover use. And we worked it out. But yeah, even publishers use stock illustrations.
Of course.
Yeah, well,
they
and
do.
Publishers will, you know, also outsource stuff. There was one of my international editions, the publisher in that country wanted to use the original art from Gift of Failure in the US. And apparently my publisher had outsourced that art to someone that didn't necessarily work under that for HarperCollins. And so that art was no longer available because that person, for whatever reason, wasn't making it available. So there's all kinds of snags that you can run up against with illustrators and licensing and all that stuff.
Yeah, I bet that, like, almost half of U.S. traditionally published books have some element of licensed stock art on them.
Interesting.
I see it all over the place.
And now we will all see it all over the place.
Well, I'm in that phase right now where I'm paying a lot of attention to covers, because the cover for my next book is going to be really, really tricky. Because for me, I would love it if people would see this next book and identify it somehow with me or my brand or my, you know, my pre-existing cover art. How exactly you convey the title, which, by the way, we think is probably going to stick. We probably think we're going to stick with the title, The Addiction Inoculation. We had a very specific conversation about this. And there are some worrisome images that you can use. You know, it's a hard, you know, suddenly.
We've spent some time coming up with the worst possible combination of pencils and the addiction inoculation.
Yeah,
we've enjoyed it, but, you know, it's probably time to give it a rest.
Exactly. So what they end up with. So now I have tastes in covers, and they may not necessarily be what's on trend right now. So it's going to be really interesting to see what they come up with, and I'm going to be brainstorming a lot about what possible, you know, covers could look like. In fact, I even got an email recently from someone who said, you know what, I was in a bookstore recently, and I had this idea for you. And believe me, those things are welcome. I love that. So
Serena, walk us through creating a cover for as an indie published author. Like, where do you start?
Well,
where are you getting
this art?
How do you find a person? What do you do?
You know, there are 10 or 15 cover artists that my friends and I all use. And you can look at somebody's copyright page and see who did their design. So that's one place to start. Or you can even search, you know, book cover art.
And yeah, if you search this, people definitely pop up. But I personally wouldn't have any way of evaluating them.
Yeah.
Other, I guess I could look at their covers because we can judge them by their book cover.
Right. And I honestly look at designers' websites all the time and I rarely find what I'm looking for because I'm just super picky now. But the important thing is to find someone who understands the genre, because without that key component, it doesn't matter how talented they are. In romance, if somebody showed me a cover without humans on it, like in some way, that I would not be able to take that. And of course, these things are really dependent upon the location as well. So all of my German books have flowers on them or other vegetation, and they are so pretty. They are just gorgeous. But the first time I saw that flower cover, or actually it was a tree for a different book, I was a little panicked. Like, people won't know this is a romance if there's no people on it. It's a tree. How is anyone going to understand? But that was me just trapped inside my own stereotypical understanding of what I see at the bookstore when I look at a cover. And Germans just don't need that, I guess.
The cultural divide can also be really interesting. One of my prettiest covers, I have no idea how it would get any gift of failure kind of idea across. It's Korean and it's got this beautiful deer on it, but someone told me that it actually appeals quite well in Korea. So who knows what I know. And by the way, your German covers, I think, are some of the most beautiful covers out there. I love them so much.
Well, they were just geniuses with this, because the first flower one came out, I believe, in March or April. And I began seeing it all over Instagram next to pictures of real flowers. And it just photographed really well, and the season hit it just right. And it's pretty great.
All right.
Darn it. When my book comes out, it's too early for sunflowers. If I planted some inside really early. I took a bunch of sunflower pictures thinking of Instagram and my book before I even knew that there were going to be sunflowers on the cover, actually, because sunflowers are very Kansas.
Yeah.
And I like sunflowers. Sunflowers are happy. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it's all about me. sorry.
Well, and the interesting thing is there are some people who, you know, also try to hook their website art into their cover art. And some people's website art ended up I'm thinking about Gretchen Rubin specifically. She worked with a designer who sort of helped do branding for her all over the place. And that art from the branding company ended up also being her cover art. And so, you know, there's all kinds of convoluted ways this can happen. But some of the most recognizable art out there. I think Gretchen's art is incredibly recognizable from her Happiness Project. And that was the result of a branding company, a partnership with a branding company. So anyway, there are lots of ways to tackle this beast, I suppose.
Yeah. And then when you get your cover art, I would guess as an indie, you probably want to make sure that you have it licensed so that you can use it in every possible scenario. And if you're working with a publisher, you can ask, can I have the elements of the... So for example, I asked for the sunflower background so that I could use it as a background for social media and for some paper stuff that I wanted
Brilliant.
To do. So it doesn't have the cover image. It only has the sunflowers on it. You can take your own cover art, whether it is indie or publisher driven, and you can take a screenshot of a tiny chunk of the color and then go to what color is, like, just Google what color is this, mm-hmm. and pop the screenshot in there and it'll give you the number.
Right.
So you'll get this crazy number, you know, I6432, this crazy 6-digit/letter number that signifies that color digitally, and you can go to Canva and make your brand palette with all of your colors, and you should, and then you can use that for everything. You can ask your publisher what your font is, and then you'll have to look. Can you you know, maybe Canva and other places have that font. Maybe I actually had to buy the font that they used on my title and for, you know, $7.99 or whatever. But I bought it and I bought the license so that I can use it on, you know, cards and things like that.
Yeah.
If so I want smart. To. A publisher might pay for that for you, but in this case, it was not worth it. The amount that it cost to buy the font was not worth it. And then once you've bought the font, you can upload it to Canva.
Yep.
There's a lot you can do with this stuff
once you've got
it in hand. Yep.
I have these lovely ones, book plates with pencils on them, and that's been a wonderful thing to have, and it matches the book. I love it. So, we are running up against the end of our time, but I want to make sure we have time to talk about what we've been reading, because I've been reading a lot.
Are we done with talking about covers of
songs? Well, I don't know. So I mean, we're at, like, I'm happy to go over, and I assume our listeners are happy to go over, but there is definitely a lot to talk about, and definitely a lot to talk about when it comes to, you know, cultural stuff. But
yeah, we didn't talk about like trends in nonfiction and the sort of the big book cover, which is the, you know, basically nothing but letters on. You know, either a background or a background image, or right. I was reading some interesting stuff about how there's a new trend for like having the illustration kind of overlap the letters. So that's a neat thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's just fun to see what's coming and then watch for it. It makes you look at covers differently, even while all the while you're using them in your mind to judge whether or not you would want to read the book. Because the truth is that is... we do judge a book by its cover.
Well, and I, you know, it was funny when I was looking at covers for Gift of Failure, I kept sending pictures to my agent of covers that I love, and she would text back and she'd say, or she'd email back and she'd say, yeah, Jess, that book sold like 40 copies. And I was like, I can't help it that my taste in book covers is a little esoteric, but whatever. Books. Let's do it, people.
All right.
What have you been reading, KJ?
I've actually been reading a lot. It's been a good season for reading for me. So I've been all over Instagram with, doing a new thing. I'm doing book chats with Serena also does, where I do a little video about the book that I've been reading. It's been a really good reading season, but I'm going to pull one out, partly because I like the cover. I just finished Tuesday Mooney Talks to Ghosts. I loved it. And it's got a gorgeous blue cover with this sort of horoscopy look, or zodiac looking thing around the type. It's a big book cover in that the type takes up most of the cover, but there is a person on it, which I guess, do we think having the person on it sort of signifies fiction? I think it might.
Really? Well, what are you talking about in terms of a person?
Well,
like, are we talking
about... It's illustrated. This is an illustrated cover, but it does have, like, a silhouette of a person. And it's actually, now that I'm sort of coming to think of it, kind of rare to see silhouettes of people or any form of people or body part on nonfiction other than memoir.
True.
And I'm sure there are exceptions to this, but I'm just thinking about, like, what are the subliminal cues here?
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that.
Anyway... Tuesday Mooney, it's a little bit Ready Player One-esque. There's a millionaire with a big game. There is a ghosty element, but it is not, it's not a very strong, I don't know, it's strong, but it's not like magical realism world. It's very much the real world with a flair of ghostiness, which I like very much. The characters are all incredibly fun. No matter how small the characters in the book, you would totally have a beer with that person. And it really, as a writer, reminded me of what I think of as fun in a book, and that I need to focus on those things.
All right.
Anyway, recommend.
I can't wait to read it.
That's do you have any more, or is that it for you today?
No, that's I'm gonna leave the others for other episodes.
Okay. So I have a couple. Serena, do you mind if I go next?
You should go next because I don't have a meaningful contribution.
Okay. All right. Well, I have a fair number because I've been traveling a fair amount to speak. And so that means audiobooks, obviously, and lots of time on planes. And I was in New York, walking all over New York. I got so much great walking done and listening to books. I just, speaking of great covers, I just finished a book by Christopher McDougall, who wrote Born to Run and a couple of other books. You know, the one about the Tarahumara tribe running in running this ultra marathon. His new book is Running with Sherman, and Sherman is a donkey. So, of course, there is a fantastic picture of a donkey on the cover of this book. And so obviously nonfiction tells you exactly what the book is going to be about. It's about running with a donkey, and it's great. I loved the book. It's, you know, Christopher McDougall is so good at doing, going off on really appropriate tangents, whether that's relationships with animals, mental health. There's a whole side story because of one person in the book about a mental health issue and how animals can affect your mental health. And anyway, so the story of Sherman, this donkey that he rescued from near death and then ended up running a race, a long distance sort of burrow. It's a thing, apparently, running with burrows. And it's very, very funny. So that book had a great cover. And then two of the books I listened to, both of which were kind of rom-com-y, were illustrated. One was Frankly in Love by David Yoon. And that was a YA, although, you know, that line between upper YA and adult, it's so such a fine and silly line. But this book was fantastic.
Tuesday Mooney sits on that line too.
Really?
Totally. It's totally got a Y. It's got YA characters.
Uh-huh.
Some of them, but it's also got adult characters. It's, well, and you know what? Ready Player One sits on that line.
Yeah, that's true.
I read it. My kids read it. So love this books
is,
like that.
Well, and this is definitely a first love story. And it's, you know, a kid finishing high school and going into college kind of thing. But I also learned a ton about Korean culture. The characters are Korean, and it's just, it was a wonderful love story. And then the other illustrated cover rom-com-y book I read that I just started today and I'm already completely in love with is Twice in a Blue Moon by Christina Lauren. And I did not know until Serena told me that these are two separate authors. I did not realize that they're a team.
Yeah, and Christina and Lauren.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it sounds like they have, what, like 30 books under their belt? And they're great.
Well, they
this
are
one
great
so far is fantastic. It's there's an echo of The Accidentals there, Serena, that's really interesting. And it's just, it's really well, you know, it's just a really fun story to listen to while I'm baking and things like that. And there were also two books that I'm not going to mention that I wanted to throw across the room in frustration because they didn't stick the landing. And that was incredibly frustrating for me, especially since one of them is in all the airport bookstores because it's a current bestseller at Hudson Books. And I just get so angry. Like, this has happened to us many times where I say there's this book, I'm so excited, it's on the bestseller list, and it's another suspense-y kind of, you know, story. And I get so excited and I get into the characters, and then, man, it just falls flat at the end and I get so angry. I just get
endings
so
are
angry.
Hard.
Yeah, I know they're
and,
hard.
And it's really hard. I think it's really hard not, I mean, I read something recently, which I will at some point talk about in an episode, because I did end up liking it, but I'm not going to name it right now, because this is mildly critical. You know, at the end, you could see the wheels.
Yeah.
You know, the machine was cranking.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I mean, I think you could say that about almost any book. If you lose your suspension of disbelief for any reason, and yet you still keep reading. And sometimes as writers, I think we might lose our suspension of disbelief in ways that we wouldn't as readers. Like something mm-hmm. pulls you out and makes you go, oh, I remember them putting this in the, you know, chapter four. And then all of a sudden you're watching the writing. And now it's hard not to see the machine moving because, you know, that there's a machine. That's
one of the two books yeah. that I wanted to throw across the room, though, had a clanking machine so loud that well, I nearly said out loud on the streets of New York, that makes no sense and could never happen. I was so irritated. It was just really, really irritating to me. But I guess I'll leave it at that. You know, I have some other critical things to say. But it's been a really fun reading period because I've realized I've got some dark stuff going on that I'm dealing with personally, and so I'm in a happy place with rom-coms, and that's really, really fun.
Oh, good.
So
nice.
Yep. And we should also probably close up soon because my dogs have decided that they have been locked up in this room with me long enough, and so they're about to start making some really weird noises.
I had a cat in my lap for part of this. I don't know if anyone could hear the purring, but it's very unusual in my house for that to happen, so I had to just let it happen.
Oh, good. Well, we have pugs snoring. We have snoring in lots of episodes, so why not purring? It makes sense. All right, I think we're good, people. I think I missed you guys because you did one without me, and so I'm so happy to be back. You recorded a podcast without me.
Before we sign up, yes. Let me just remind everybody that if you would like the show notes for this episode, you can always find them at amwritingpodcast.com. If you are interested in getting our top fives for writers, which come out weekly, the most recent one was Top 5 Book Bub with Secrets for Authors, you can also go to amwritingpodcast.com and sign up to be a supporter of the podcast. Do that and the weekly top fives will drop into your mailbox, as well as our new mini supporter episodes, of which we have so far recorded one. And I'm using the we in the royal term, but you know, we're doing more and more. We're loving building this writerly community, which I might add, you can also check out on Facebook by looking for the Am Writing group.
All right, Serena, would you like to say the words at the end?
I think you should, because you're back this
weekend.
Okay,
that's true, because I was gone. I missed saying them. So, okay, until next week, everyone, keep your butts in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag AmWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Thank you.